Hey everyone, how's it? This is Nate. I get to welcome you to the show and to talk about the sponsors of today's podcast. The first sponsor that I'm going to talk about is Hoist, as in Hoist Hydration. Hoist is not like the other hydration drinks that are out there because of the way that it's been specifically formulated to match your body's natural osmolality, which means that you can absorb Hoist rapidly without the actual need for hydration, so it's super quick acting. It's got three times the electrolytes of the traditional sports drinks that are out there with only half of the sugars. I don't know about you, but I'm actually grateful for the half of the sugars that they left in there because I like things that taste good. But it doesn't have high fructose corn syrup, the artificial preservatives, sweeteners, or dyes, or any of that other crap. So it's something that I can actually drink, feel good about it, taste good, and it quickly hydrates me. If you're interested, head on over to drinkhoist.com where you can use the code FIELDCRAFT10 for 10% off at checkout. The next sponsor of the podcast that I want to talk about is SIG, as in SIG Sauer. SIG, I got to go to their special event before SHOT Show. It was super cool. I love all the innovation. They had all of the everything broken down, the SIG Cross, the all their pistols, carbines, all the things like laid out wall to wall with tons of people who could tell me really cool, nerdy facts about them that I thought was actually kind of fun and interesting. I love all the modular builds that they're coming out with. Everything's super customizable. I've had the Army's new M17 for a while with a Delta Point Pro, and it's been a super fun pistol to be able to go through and train with. It's actually the first one that I put a red dot on, so I got to go through that whole no red dot to a red dot transition with the SIG, and it's been a fun thing to do. So thanks, SIG Sauer, for everything that you're doing, and make sure you head on over and check out the awesome stuff that they're doing over there and pick something up. With that, let's head on over to the show.
What's going on, guys? Kevin Estella with the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I am not going to touch this microphone. Spent like 15 minutes just trying to screw around, figure out how to get this thing to work without any issue. And, you know, it was ticking like crazy. And I don't think you guys want to hear a bunch of tick, 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 the way that I was hearing it. At least that's not what I think you don't want to hear. I mean, maybe you do. Maybe you think my voice sounds like, I don't know, fingernails on a chalkboard. But guys, in any case, this is going to be an awesome podcast because I get a chance to talk to one of my assistant instructors who's going to be, you know, stepping into the role of primary instructor in the Pacific Northwest. And we get to do a little bit of an after action about a survival course that we just ran out there. This was a fun one. It was a nut punch in a lot of different ways, but we got through it and people had a great time. And, you know, there was just so much to talk about. So on my, my flight home just a couple days ago on my red eye, you know, because the flight was from Pacific Northwest to Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C. down to Raleigh. And I left the airport at like 11 o'clock at night, Seattle time, and got in around 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. So I had a lot of time to write some stuff down, just kind of bullet point ideas that I wanted to talk to my buddy about. And I think you guys are going to enjoy this. So if you've ever wondered, like, how do you survive in extremely wet conditions and what kind of survival techniques and skills and lessons learned can be gathered from training in the Pacific Northwest, you better pay attention to this one. So guys, on the phone with me is my buddy Jared. You might know him on Instagram as Army Mace. And like I said, he's going to be taking over the role of primary instructor for that survival class out there because that's his backyard. Jared, how you doing, buddy?
Good, sir.
Yeah, sorry for that highly caffeinated introduction, but it's been a long day already. And on top of it, I got a whole bunch of stuff I got to do this afternoon. But let's just jump right into this. Pacific Northwest, in particular, Granite Falls, we were at Greg Anderson's place. Greg Anderson has been working with Fieldcraft, working with Glover, you know, hosting a bunch of shooting events and whatnot. And we were like, let's do a survival class out there. So we go out to Greg Anderson's place. First and foremost, I got to give a big shout out to him. Probably the best advanced notification and advanced packet that I've ever received was his information about, here's my car. It's a, you know, 4Runner and it's going to be parked here and you can find the keys here and inside you're going to find X, Y, and Z. And by the way, I got you beef snacks and here's the key to the gate. And here, like, I have never seen an advance packet better than that.
Here's a backup axe and chainsaw.
Yeah, right. And, oh, by the way, you needed a cast iron pan. Here you go, buddy. And then, oh, if you need this, this, and this, there's a bottle of CLP in the back, you know, in case it rusts. Like, the guy thought of everything. But, you know, if you look up Greg Anderson's background, former Ranger, you know, the dude squared away. So you guys have a great representative out there on the West Coast. But let's get right to, like, we meet up at the gate. We had a sold out course, which I appreciate the hell out of you guys for trusting us to come out on a sold out weekend to train with us in the pouring rain. But we met up at the gate. You spent the night. Did you sleep there? I don't even think I asked you that. Did you sleep at the gate?
Oh, yes, sir. I got early and did a little bit of reconnaissance of the site to check it out.
And you said that you had a set of eyes that was following you, right?
Yeah, there was a – on my way out, there was a pair of eyes, probably a coyote from their height. And just kept staying right out of my flashlight's range.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, ooh, there are animals out here.
Yeah. And, you know, for that trip, I didn't bring my usual Glock. You know, if I'm out in the – in Utah, I'll carry a Glock 19 or a Glock 17. 9mm is good enough for cats. I just received a Colt Python, and full disclosure, this is the first time this has ever happened. I was given a firearm. I was like, holy crap, this is awesome. I've never received a firearm free like that before. Colt hooked me up. I'm a Connecticut boy, and I toured their company, and they were very generous to do that. So I respect them for doing that. And I was like, I'm bringing a 357 with me because, you know, there could be bigger predators out there. And that's a stainless gun, a 4-inch Python 357. Jerry let me borrow some hard cast rounds because I didn't have any for it yet. And that was definitely a concern, right? Because Pacific Northwest has some pretty big apex predators. And we talked about the coyotes a little bit on the around the fire. Can you just explain a little bit to the audience? Because you brought up some interesting facts about coyotes, about them in pairs.
So Craig actually has a really great podcast on the coyotes in America.
Craig Caudill, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Craig Caudill. But some of the highlights is they're one of 19 species who can break off in pairs and continue to survive. They won't just die off. Every effort to eradicate them or move them away from human areas has failed miserably and doubled or tripled their population. So the only thing you can do is kind of ignore them unless you're going to do a mass hunt to remove them from that area, and you have to get all of them. But they're very smart. They're very crafty. They've replaced wolves in a lot of areas, so they've gotten a little bit bigger because they eat a little bit better. They're very brave, and they're very smart. A lot of people have a bad idea about them in America due to a poem that was written by, I can't think of his name right now. How he said they were mangy animals, but they're not. They're actually really intelligent, really crafty, and they're really brave. So I brought my rifle just in case and had it staged so anybody could easily access it.
But we didn't have any
truck.
But we didn't have any issues with them. They did visit the camp, according to some of the guys that were there. They're like, yeah, we heard them running around like crazy. But I didn't see anyone when I was there. And you just had that one interaction with them when you hiked in that first night, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So now we get the gate open, we get down to the site, and you know, we're a pretty good distance in, right? There's a big construction gate there. So we get into the site, people are pulling in, they get out of their vehicles. And one of the first things that we do on any course is we say, all right, guys, how did you find out about the class? What's your name? And what would you like to get out of it? And one of the things that came up, and it was a frequent comment, was, I don't know anything about the great outdoors. I'm just very interested in learning. So they didn't have a lot of awareness of what they were getting into, but they were totally willing to go out in the freezing rain, not freezing, the very cold rain, and kind of put themselves in a very, I won't say a weak position, but a vulnerable position. Were you taken back by anyone's capability, or did you find anything interesting? Like when people were like, oh, I never knew anything about this. Like what was the biggest shocker for you when you found out like why people were there?
So I noticed a few people, they were more familiar with rifle courses and the pistol and safety courses. And then there was a bunch of people who were just plain new. There was an older gentleman who just wanted a refresher. There's a search and rescue guy who was there, just wanted more training. But there was definitely a lot of newness to the environment. And some of the things that threw me off was that clothing selection.
Yeah, let's start
and
there.
After about the first 2 hours, people went back to their vehicles and changed some of their clothing.
Okay, so we were expecting rain the entire weekend. Temperatures were mid-30s to low-40s. There wasn't a really crazy temperature swing. But, I mean, I wore a full hard shell rain suit. And underneath my pants, I had on a pair of Prometheus Design Works. Let's see, what kind of pants were they? They were all synthetic. And then underneath that, I had a pair of Patagonia Capeline full-length leggings on. And then for my core, I had a Fieldcraft Survival Performance t-shirt, so a long-sleeve shirt. I had on a Patagonia R1 fleece, so the micro waffle. And then I had on a Patagonia puffy jacket, which I've had for freaking like 7 years now. And then I had the outer layer. And I stayed perfectly dry the whole weekend. But what was it that you saw people wearing that you were like, oh my God?
A couple of the footwear selection. Some of the people were out there in tennis shoes and they changed to boots. That kind of threw me off for a minute. And then I'm a big fan of the Canvas heavy duty work pants. And a couple guys were out in that. And they changed their pants to some rain pants very shortly after.
Yeah. And then, on top of that, some of the jackets were nylon jackets, but they weren't rain jackets. You know, they were jackets that were good for like blocking wind, but they weren't intended for blocking rain. And I didn't really see anyone jackhammering, like getting really, really cold. But I did see people like noticeably uncomfortable being wet. And that's to be expected, right? I mean, you're out there, everything feels sore when you leave the woods like that. When you're in the woods for 36 hours or 48 hours, 72 hours, whatever, you always feel a little sore after that. So that was like my big takeaway, you know, for the clothing selection was, you know, good footwear. I mean, even Julian, our photographer who was out there, Julian was wearing tennis shoes, but then he borrowed a Lester River wool jacket from you. And then I think it was just like an outdoor brand poncho from one of the other students. And Julian was pretty snug after that. Cause he showed up and he was like, I'm just going to wear this disposable poncho. And it was like, dude, you have no idea how bad the rain is here. Like Granite Falls has an annual rainfall of like over 50 inches. And Seattle, by contrast, has a rainfall of 39 inches. So over 50 inches, 39 inches, it's more than Seattle, constantly raining.
Yeah, he ended up taking that disposable poncho and wrapping his cameras up in it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He did do that. Now, let's talk about some of the other gear, since it was very gear heavy. The knives. Which knives do you recall seeing students using?
Oh, there was a lot of Moras, a couple Essie knives. One of the gentlemen had a very small custom knife, which was actually looked like it was more of a utility skinning knife. There's a K-bar out there, a Smith & Wesson dagger.
Which, by the way, let's not call out the guy by name, but the guy with the Smith & Wesson dagger cut his hand, his finger, with the dagger within 5 minutes of learning how to use knives.
Yeah, it was rainy and the knives were slippery. So that didn't help some people. Somebody had an older hunting knife. A lot of the students learned that their knives they thought might have been sharp were definitely not sharp enough, which I've noticed because they were struggling. They were doing more repetitive, trying to small hack cuts instead of a rocking cut.
Mm-hmm. And then some were just trying to, like, instead of rocking it, they were just sawing with the knife blade back and forth, but they weren't getting anywhere because they didn't have a good edge to begin with. I mean, what's always interesting to me is when people are bringing a knife to the class, they think that it's, you know, you say survival class, right? And there are people who take these courses who are, you know, upwards of our age, and they grew up in the 80s and the 90s, and they think like, okay, Rambo had a Lyle, and, you know, Predator, they were all carrying Crane hollow-handled knives, and Crocodile Dundee, and, you know, I think the only jackass out there with a large knife was me, but I did it because I wanted to, right? Like, I brought that big old Fall Even modern Bowie, but for the most of the course I was using their F1 Pro. And steel choice mattered because some of the knives were starting to show rust early on out there in the Pacific Northwest. I would say stainless is the way to go. I mean, you can get away with carbon. And a student said, well, how do you prevent carbon from rusting? And I said, you got to let your knife get a patina, right? You got to use it. It'll, you know, preserve the steel a little bit better than just, you know, high polish where it's going to create spots for rust to get attracted to. But I think stainless is the way to go out there. I mean, you were carrying the Fieldcraft knife. Did you have any others with you? I'm sorry. You had the Fieldcraft knife and then you had the, God, not Enzo, Entrek.
The Entrek Forester.
Yeah. But have you found that like you came up with like a solution to all the wet weather? Because you're out there, I mean, and you've got a bunch of carbon knives.
A couple of my carbon knives, the ones that the students were borrowed, were gun glued.
Oh, okay. Okay. What'd you use? The
Birch Casey's, I want to say it was.
Yeah, it's like true blue or dark blue or something like that, like the at-home bluing.
The Moras that I handed out for people to replace their knives they weren't having as much luck with were all gun blued.
Okay. Now, one of the first challenges that we do after the students learn how to use knives is building fire. And I just wrote a blog on this one. I'm not sure if this podcast is coming out before the blog or if it's coming out after the blog. But, you know, there are a few really, really important takeaways. Out there, you just cannot give up. I mean, you're going to get defeated. Even experienced people are going to get defeated out there where everything is going to be very, very wet. And tinder is really the king. You know, if we look at what makes a fire, it's heat, fuel, and air. And out there, the heat is just getting pulled away by all the wetness. And it's, you know, all the fuel is waterlogged. So what was your perception of how the students did? And like, what did you notice like their evolution was? Because I had to do a couple of videos with Julian and I got pulled away when you guys made the fire down by the water. And then you guys made multiple fires. You even showed them like how to find fatwood and cedar bark and things like that. So what was your perception of how the students did and like what gave them success out there?
So one of the students had fire in probably about 2 or 3 minutes, but couldn't keep it sustained because they weren't using enough small stuff or small enough, like continuing to make it smaller and enough of it to get anything larger going. They had their initial flame the fastest, but it was just barely hanging on the whole time as they were working. And another student spent 30 minutes just trying to get their flame, but once they had it going, their fire was established. The second day when we did the fire down by the water, they all worked together and they all worked to build a ton of tinder into the fire. Some of it was because I told them they were allowed to use their petroleum jelly or their pitch wood. And they worked all that together and they added a ton more kindling than they did the first day, which got them enough fire to actually boil a cup of water. I don't think we ever got them to boiling the cup of water because we had to move on because we were running short on time.
Don't mind me. So the company Hoist, that's one of the podcast sponsors. They just sent me this this military hydration drink. And it's like remember Capri Sun back in the day?
Yes.
Yeah, like little foil packets. Well, they sent me this one that is kind of like a cross between Capri Sun and a kid's like applesauce container that's like squeezable. And I just tried drinking it and I never drank from it before. And I think I just drooled all over myself. Full disclosure.
That tart.
It happens, you know. Okay, so the fire process, those guys, they realize the importance of fire, you know, and what's interesting is, you know, when everyone's standing around and we're doing that interest inventory and we're like, hey, where'd you hear about us? Whatever, whatever. Everyone is kind of tight lipped. Then they get the fire going and people just start talking, right? You notice that like fire boosts their morale. And then at night, no one wanted to stand in the dark. They're all drawn to where the fire was. The next morning, making coffee, they're all drawn to the fire. So I would say that it's not unreasonable for you to everyday carry multiple fire starters and even tinder on your person if you understand the difficulty of making fire. So let's go to day one. We wrapped up with fire. We then moved on to making shelters, right? Or did we do knots?
Yes.
We did fire. We did shelters. Okay. So
we did shelters.
We went really heavy with showing them how to properly set up a tarp. Using a toggle on one side of the tree, using a trucker's hitch on the other side, two half hitches, and then setting up their tarp either in A-frame, lean-to, asymmetrical, diamond, whatever it was. And out there, the reason why we went so heavy with tarp is because, I mean, that tarp is really a multi-tool out there. It's shelter. It can be worn as a jacket. You can use it to collect water. I mean, it can do a lot of different things. But then after they did the tarp lesson, and we covered a lot of details about tarps and optimal ways of carrying things, we said, Greg has been kind enough to let you guys build natural shelters. And we said, we're going to have team A and we're going to have team B. Team A made the A-frame. Team B made a lean-to. What did you notice in the way that they built their shelters? Because, I mean, you bounced back and forth with them just as much as I did.
So one of the things that I wanted to remind them of is they were building a shelter in teams. And in a loss situation, it's like you're going to be alone. So most of your time building a shelter is going to be just to keep your mind busy. But they needed to do more layering. Their structure was good. The lean-to guys used already down tree that was being held up by another tree very, very sturdily. Then they added some more cross braces. And as they started adding down and ferns and stuff, I had to remind them that the water falls off the plants naturally in one way. You brought that up. I brought up that they needed to keep it getting thicker and thicker and thicker if they wanted any warmth being retained, and that it needed to be small on the inside but massive on the outside. So just enough for you to be comfortable in, maybe curled up, and then continuing like a foot maybe more of the ferns. And I spent the night in the lean-to, which was a bit drippy. The A-frame, they also used it, what looked like a pre-established vine maple, just running at probably about a 30, 45 degree angle. And then they built their frame on it. But one of the things was they didn't have enough bedding in either of them to prevent heat loss from the ground. But we also cut them on time, so they gave them a 45-minute time limit to work on it. And what was it? Teams of nine building shelters.
Yeah, so you could basically multiply the amount of time that they had, which is about 45 minutes, by the number of people. And assuming they could work at that same capacity for that full length of time, that's what they could expect for someone to make a shelter in, which, if nothing else, it impressed upon them the importance of bringing a tarp, bringing good clothing to begin with, and bringing, you know, a sleeping bag that you can sleep inside of. I mean, I think many times when we teach primitive skills, it's really meant to show the value of good tools and that you should never leave them behind. Like, you're very proficient with friction fire. I've seen you make friction fire a bunch of times, but you even struggled out there with it because there's just so much moisture. And the big joke is always like, if cavemen had to exist today and could take a Bic lighter or a bow drill set, they would take the Bic lighter, you know, and if you can give them a ferro rod and a Bic lighter, they would leave behind everything else, you know, that was fire related from their time. So we went real heavy with knife, real heavy with fire starting, real heavy with shelter on day one. And then we said, guys, set up your shelters for the night. And then, you know, let's hang out by the fire. And around the fire, you showed them a lot of primitive technology. You showed them all of your cordage. And I mean, why am I saying what you showed them? Tell the audience what you showed them around the fire, because you had some really interesting stuff with like the cordage and the bowls and the carvings and stuff like that.
So after we did the initial, the tri-sticks and some basic notching, the fire shelters, we moved into a little bit of signaling. We covered more signaling on day two. But towards the evening, I was showing them all the comparisons. This is all the older primitive stuff. And a couple of students worked with me on how to make the cord or the fire start and stuff. And I was showing them it's so much more time. It's just smarter to bring the modern equivalent and go prepared in the first place instead of trying to be the Rambo-like guy running around with a knife and I'm going to make everything out there. Having that skill set gives you the true gives you a better value understanding of why you need that stuff. Because it's just so much simpler to pull out some paracord out of a hip pack or a chest pack or a backpack than it is to sit there and spin up 30 feet of cord and make your shelter. And then I went and do some of the more equivalents, why it's better to have a good steel knife over a stone knife. Because some of the, in a Granite Falls area, there's maybe like six rocks that we found that could have made a sharp edge really well. A couple of quartz rocks, a couple of jasper stones. But most of the stuff was a small crumbly rock or sandstone. It's like, and you're not going to find it very easily in the forest. You're only going to find it along the waterway in this area. So it's just easier and smarter to have an actual knife. And then we, I showed them the burn bowls, and like, it's like you can carry a canteen or a cooking pot, or you can spend 2 hours making a bowl like this to even collect your water in.
Yeah, not to mention you can make a survival kit or an emergency kit out of like a Morris pot or an MSR stowaway pot or something that actually has some utility instead of just like a nylon bag, which granted it has some utility, but you're not boiling water in a sil nylon bag the way that you're boiling it in a stainless steel pot. I think it was just very eye-opening. And I keep going back to that idea in my head of like the blank slate, you know, and it was funny because every so often guys would say, oh, I just ordered something online, right? Or you'd see them taking out their phone and be like, well, I'm buying one of those when I go home, you know? So that night around the fire, we're telling them more ideas and we're sharing some of the Fieldcraft, you know, funny inside stories about this thing and that thing and, you know, different personalities at the company. And then everyone went to sleep and that night it rained. I slept under a light fighter tarp. I had a piece of Tyvek on the ground. I had two sleeping pads. I always travel with two when I do one of those. One is a self-inflating from Thermarest. It's actually the military issue one. And then I've got a Thermarest Z Fold. Then I had the Kefaru body bag with me, or mountain bag. And I had a bivy sack that I put over the top of that just because I knew it was going to be damp. You spent part of the night in the student shelters. Then you said it, you got rained on, right?
Hey, what's going on, guys? Ketone IQ. Yeah, this is a mid-roll break. We're talking about Ketone IQ, a product I've been using for years now. It's made by HVMN. And it's a product that I've been using because I do have traumatic brain injury. I also have a little bit of fogginess, but it could benefit everybody because it gives you the same clarity you would get when you're in ketosis. That ketone ester puts you in that ketosis state of mental clarity, and it's like caffeine without the jitters. I love it. So if you're interested in Ketone IQ, go ahead and go to HVMN. That's HotelVictorMN.com. That's Hotel Victor Mike November. HVMN.com and use Fieldcraft, one word, to save 15%. Again, go to HVMN.com and save 15% off with the code Fieldcraft. Now back to the podcast.
Yeah. So the lean-to had a bunch of moss thatching. The problem with the moss thatching in the rainy environment is it worked like a wick or a sponge, and it was just dripping on me. I spent four and a half hours in that one. And then I went and spent an hour in the other one, but you could feel the wind straight through it still.
Yeah.
And then I was like, all right, I'm done. I'm moving to my my dry stuff to warm up for a little bit. We only got like three more hours. So we got to get going.
Yeah. And I give you credit for sleeping in there. You know, when we were doing the students review each other's shelters, they're like, yeah, I can see right through here. And oh, if we had more time. And the whole idea is, you know, you make a shelter and then every single day you make it a little bit better. And over time, as the wind and the rain and all the elements are starting to weigh on the thatching, it makes it, you know, more water resistant, but that takes time. And, you know, we just weren't there just to show how to do natural shelters. If we had 8 hours in the day, we could make a pretty bomber, you know, mandan or a heated shelter. You know, unfortunately we just don't. We have to cover a lot of different skills.
Yeah. It was showing the importance of having a tarp or a tent.
Yeah, which is very
available over the primitive shelters.
And again, it's very skills heavy, limited gear. Day two, students wake up. We do a little bit of a AAR for the night. And, you know, from one night into the second, four students didn't finish the class, which you know, I'm not going to beat them down. I'm not that type of instructor. I'm not going to be like, oh, you suck. You know, you didn't man up, right? Because that type of thing can destroy a student's morale. And they are already more willing than a bunch of the armchair commandos that will say, well, that's not how I would do it. Well, guess what? This is how someone actually tried and they actually made the effort. You didn't do jack, you know what? So those four folks, I've said it in an Instagram video recently, and I'm going to say it on the podcast for the record. If they did not finish day one into day two, they can come back to any 2-day survival class and do the second day's worth of curriculum and lessons, because I want you guys to get educated. I want you to learn the skills, because that's the commitment we have at Fieldcraft to the student. And we're not going to beat you down. Now, if you guys want us to beat you down, we can do it after the class. We'll make you like jump in the mud and I don't know, like do all sorts of gross stuff, but we're not going to do that now. All right. So what do we start with on day two? I'm trying to even remember.
It was a little bit slow going because some of the students were just worn down, beat down from the weather. So we kind of started off with more rope work, knot work.
Oh, wait. Before that, we did coffee and bread.
Oh, yeah. You did the Bannock lesson.
Oh, man. And you know, so I first learned about Bannock from my late mentor, Marty, and we used to do it on canoe trips. And I'll never forget, like, you're on a canoe trip, it's freezing cold, or, you know, the wind is just howling, and something about having warm bread in camp makes life better. So I brought pre-mixed Bannock, which it was 1 cup of flour, 1 teaspoon of baking powder, a pinch of salt, and that ratio multiplies each time you add more cups of flour. Then I added sugar, cinnamon, raisins, and we did cinnamon raisin bread. And the first one I made with the cast iron pan came out okay, but then the students really got into it. I mean, even Julian put his camera down and he made one of them for his own. And, you know, next thing you know, all the students are like, oh, this bread's really good. And they're all writing down the recipe. And, you know, all the tough guys from the day before that didn't want to talk to each other when I was like, so where's everyone from? Da, 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 da. Now they're all like, try my bread. Try this. And then the coffee, many of the students never tried cowboy coffee before, which is just putting coffee grinds into a pot with water, letting it boil over, taking it off the heat. And then the coffee settles to the bottom and you pour it. And every once in a while you get some coffee grinds in your teeth, but for the most part, it's coffee. And they're like, oh, that's great. I didn't know you didn't need a filter, but you came up with a solution that does what? 10 cups of coffee in a 6-cup pot. What was that?
So basically what I did was make a giant version of a tea bag. I call them the little coffee grenades. So I have it set up for, it's good to 10, maybe 12 cups of coffee, but I have a 8-cup coffee pot. So it's got a lot of concentrated coffee. You let it boil for a little bit over the fire. And if you're ever camping with me, I almost always have a pot of water or a pot of coffee going, just because the warm water or the coffee just takes the edge away from the environment. But it's basically just a giant version of a tea bag. So you take the coffee filter and some cotton string that you use for baking your turkey or your duck, and you tie it up and you just let it go for a little bit. And that was quite enjoyed by the fire, that I ended up making a second pot in the afternoon because people wanted more.
Yeah. And we had that fire going pretty strong in the afternoon. The difference, if anyone's wondering, between day one and day two's fire, day two, they were tasked with like keeping the fire going all night. And I know some of them went over there. You went over there at one point. But then the rain came down and, you know, put out most of the fire. One of the tips is you can always turn a log over, and if you see that it's not all black like charcoal, but if there's white ash attached to the log, you know that the water hasn't gotten to it yet. So I put those on top of one another, and I got some fairly dry cedar, and I fluffed it up a bit with my blade, got the fire going. And then I basically built a log chimney, right? A log cabin, but it serves like a chimney to kind of lock in the heat, and the wood was burning like crazy. And I think that's also another important talking point, is that it always gets better, right? Day one's always rough. Day two, things just feel easier. People stopped asking as many questions on day two. I don't know if you noticed that, but like they just knew how to do things because more time in the woods meant more proficiency. And by the time that we got down to the river and you did the fire down by the river, I mean, they weren't asking how to do this or do that. Like they just did it, like you said. At one point we discussed water. And, you know, we said you can apply the PACE principle, primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency, to all the different ways of making water or treating water. So we said you can boil it, which is optimal. You can use a filter like the Grail, and I've been screwing around with the Grail, and I'm really impressed with it. You can use tabs, so the students all had a chance to treat water with aqua tabs. And then we talked about sourcing it off the land, and you brought up a point about the local moss with sourcing it off the land. Can you share it here?
So it's not ideal, but it's not to be shied away from. Sphagnum moss has a high concentration of iodine in it, so you can squeeze it out and use it as a water cleaner water source. And I demonstrated a couple different ways how to do it, and some of the guys were thrown off by it. It was like, yes, you might get some amoebas, you might get some water bears, but if you cannot get a fire and you don't have a container, you still need to drink water. And couple of the people were starting to notice the effects of not drinking as much water, because you don't feel as thirsty when it's raining all the time.
Right.
It's not like on the dry side of the state, we're in the desert areas where after an hour you're like, I need water. There you can go 5 or 6 hours without even noticing. It's like, you need water. And it's like, you don't need to, it's not always gonna be ideal. It's not always going to be pretty clean water. One of the guys did the purification in his Nalgene, and it was clear, and he could see all the cloudy calcium sediment.
Yeah.
And he's like, I know it's safe, but I can't bring myself to drink it. And I was like, how do you phrase it? Willingness and
awareness, preparedness, and willingness is the PSYOC readiness formula.
Yeah, it's like you have to be willing to keep doing what you need to do. And so the sphagnum moss has a decent concentration of naturally occurring iodines, so it keeps the water mostly clean. It also prevents other fungi from trying to grow in it. So when you find the sphagnum moss areas, they're pretty just itself. And then I showed them that the Spanish moss or old man's beard lichen, also hanging everywhere in the Pacific Northwest, collects a ton of water, and it's just easy to squeeze out and gather. Even if you don't have a dedicated water source, you can get water. Is it better to actually throw in a purification tablet or boil it? Absolutely, but you still need water even when it's cold.
Yeah, that guy who didn't want to drink the water, he also told me that he went on a hunting trip and he had no problem eating the heart of the animal that he shot with a little bit of lemon juice. And he's like, yeah, I was willing to do that. He's like, I don't know about this one. And when you take the water and you drink the water and it looks like milk, or sometimes when you're really remote and you can't find running water, the water you're drinking looks like watered down chocolate milk. You know, that's called like food aversion or water aversion, and you got to get over it. But, you know, I've heard people say that hunger makes great sauce, and thirst, you know, will make you drink pretty much anything. I mean, people resort to drinking urine and seawater, which is not advised. I'm going to say that again. Do not drink your own pee. Do not drink someone else's pee, and don't drink the ocean. But thirst makes people do stupid things. Crack does too, but so does thirst. Now, God, I mean, there are so many things that we did that weekend. You know, we talked about breaking the seal, and that was the idea of like not reaching under your jacket, opening your jacket, creating that microclimate. Students made neck carrying rigs out of paracord. We made pretty awesome smoke generators at the very end. Like, not exaggerating, I'm going to say that like that was the best smoke generator I think any class of mine has ever made. And it was basically like on a 1 foot by 1 foot fire, and they just put ferns on it. And the amount of smoke, like copious amounts of smoke, thick plumes went up. What was it? Because I could not remember the terminology that you used to describe it when I put the stick underneath the ferns and I was billowing it, keeping the fire going and creating those thicker plumes by like, I always say fluffing it, but it's not fluffing it.
You're creating an oxygen flow. So most chimneys aren't actually a straight down drop. They have like little sections that go in and out to make the smoke follow it. If it's just a straight tube, it doesn't always work great in a house. So the method is actually called a Venturi.
Okay.
If I'm pronouncing it right, it's the science nerd name for fire, how the air flows and stuff. But what you're doing is constantly creating the bellow action, and you're forcing the Venturi action in the smoke, which made it even denser and denser each time. And you're keeping the fire getting enough oxygen throughout, and it almost started to do the like the cartoon smoke signal, and then it would just be this tower of thick. We couldn't see each other from the other side of the fire, which was kind of awesome for the students. And they're putting their hands in it like, oh wow, this is so cool, I can't even see my hand. It was a very thick, steamy smoke cloud. It was more steam because the moisture being cooked out of the ferns and the cedar branch.
Yeah, it was pretty.
It was an interesting effect.
It was pretty damn awesome. Like I said, I've never seen smoke cloud like that out of such a small fire. And in the past, I used to do it where we'd build like a much larger log cabin and place the log cabin on top, or we would have the teepee fire inside a log cabin and then have the ferns pre-staged and we'd light it and hope that it would work. But just creating that kind of stretcher for the ferns and then placing it over the fire, that to me seemed like that was like the magic sauce. That worked fantastic. Now, two of the people that were on the class, they were really playing with the smoke, and I want to call them out. That was Kellen and Miroslav, and they were the two young boys who were on the class. And, you know, I'll tell you, like, I love meeting people. I love meeting the students. They definitely make the job worthwhile. But I had one of those moments where I got all like choked up. I was like, oh my God, really? Like, oh my God. And Miroslav's dad, he came up to me and he goes, hey, my son has been a fan of yours for a very long time, even before Fieldcraft. And he has your book. He's been reading your book and he wants like you to sign the book. I'm like, oh, 100%. And he came over right away with the book. And I'm like, hey buddy, I'm going to do it when my hands are dry and they're not dirty right now, but put it on the front seat of the car and I'm out of my car and I will definitely sign it. So I signed it. And then the dad tells me, he said, my son had the option of either getting a PlayStation or coming to the survival class, and he chose the survival class. And I was like, oh my God. And that kid was so cool, like very quiet. And then Kellen was like the comic relief. Like he would just say stuff. And at one point the guy was like, man, you got a comment for everything, you know? So I don't mind when kids come to courses with their parents because they add a different dynamic. And you just, as parents, you have to realize that you might hear a few other things around the campfire that you might have to explain to your kids later on, you know? But I don't know about you, but I thought those two kids were awesome.
I loved it. I loved his choice of survival course and a kit bag or a PlayStation. And he chose the chest kit kit and a survival course over a PlayStation. I was like, that is awesome. I gave him an emergency whistle to add to his kit, and he was wanting to blow on it. And Dad was like, no, not right now. I was like, he can do it during the signal portion.
Yeah, or the car ride home.
And the other young man, I gifted a small flint and steel kit because he was talking about all the different stuff, and he was so excited about his giant Exotac fire rod that he was just sparking it for probably like 10 minutes straight. But they were definitely hardworking and they were definitely absorbed into the lessons.
And now I think the listeners probably don't know that you're a very active educator with like youth education as well. And we talked about doing like a donors choose type of program or like a GoFundMe program, because you're not getting paid when you volunteer, but you are spending your own dime to buy supplies that you gift to these kids. So at some point, I'm sure if you guys follow Jared, you know, at Army Mace on Instagram, you'll see him talking about working with kids programs and whatnot. But Jared's a great educator and he's got a lot of patience when it comes to working with kids. So I'm sure at some point setting up a program like that will help you reach even a larger audience and get you more resources to share with those kids. Man, we covered a lot that weekend. And then we did our after action. Do you remember any of the comments from that? Like, did any stick out?
Some of the stuff we started with talking about in the beginning of the discussion, as a lot of them were going to make very, very different clothing selections, knife choices. They were super enthralled with like how much we knew and how the pace just never slowed down. And they're like, I'm going to have to take this again just to catch more. A couple of them said, which was kind of awesome. Because well, we did slow down on day two on the pace a little bit. It is drinking from a fire hose, because I'm going to say well over 80% of those students had never done anything wilderness survival before. And they were meeting any challenge we threw down. So like when you said at the end of like the knot section, do the ball drick this way, like six people jumped straight at it without even hesitating, trying to figure out how to do the ball drick carry. The fire thing, I think every student dropped down to try to get the fire as fast as possible, their own little individual sustained fire to get a pot of water going, which was awesome. It was just a really motivated group in a really hard environment. It's like, this is not like playing out in the summer and it's a nice sunny day. It was the weather that gets people killed, and they were out there learning in that environment. And it was pretty awesome to see.
And speaking of almost getting killed, we need to address the Widowmaker.
Oh yes, the Widowmakers.
Yeah, the Makers with an S. So at some point in the morning, right, I think it was around like 2:30 or 3, I heard a tree come down and I was like, oh my God, that was close. Like, that was really bad. And, you know, people have said like, well, what happens if a tree falls on you? It's like, I don't know. Well, what happens if lightning strikes you? You know, when it's your time, man. You know, like, you can do what you can to mitigate things. Like, don't carry a golf club on a golf course when there's lightning everywhere. And when you're camping, look up, right? Look for Widowmakers. But in this case, the whole damn tree came down close to one of the vehicles. That was more range induced, because obviously Greg uses it as a rifle range. But then there were other trees that came down throughout the middle of the night in different places.
Yeah, and the alder stands were, that's when the winds picked up about 2:30.
Mm-hmm.
The alder stands were just falling down. At one point, it sounded like it was mortar fire going off for a solid like 20 minutes, just branches or trees coming down in the middle of the night. And that one that came down was 8 feet from that dude's vehicle, but a bunch of the branches scratched the right side of his vehicle up.
Yeah. And it was a pretty nice vehicle. It was like a new full-size truck with a cap on it. And, you know, now he's got a little bit of character to the side of the vehicle.
That's a story to tell.
Yeah, for real. But it just goes to show, and like, we didn't plan that. Like, I didn't tell Greg to go out there and blast away at a tree just so it would fall. Like, you can't plan those things. But even if you're in a training scenario, you can take all the steps that you want to make sure that things are safe for the students, but you're still in the wilderness, right? You're still exposed to the elements. You're still in the wild. You can't control animals. You can't control when plants decide to fight back or fall or whatever. I mean, things happen, you know, but as I told the group, what they experienced together, all that shared food and the hardship and the fire, like, that group is bonded now. They can talk about things that, you know, our listeners, as much as I love you guys, you'll never know what those guys went through because you weren't there. And it's really, really cool as the instructor to have all those experiences with all those students, and then to get messages from them later on saying, hey, I showed my family this, or, you know, I did this with them because of the course. Like that's really why we do it. You know what I mean? So now moving forward, that area is going to become a training hub. There's no doubt about it. It was a very inexpensive flight. I mean, I had to invest more time than I had to invest money to fly out there. It was like $300 to fly out there. And there's a demand for land navigation in the Northwest. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to teach land nav. I actually just put the finishing touches on a brand new presentation that I use when I teach. And this is the best one I've ever made. And I've been teaching land nav since 2007. So I'm really excited about using this presentation. I'll use it here in Aberdeen in March, but I'm going to be out in the Pacific Northwest teaching land nav this summer, and I'll be in Connecticut teaching land nav in June, Father's Day weekend. And you are going to be up there hopefully teaching another 2-day survival class at some point. Probably, what are we looking at now? 6 months from now would be August. I don't know if you're game to do one then, but I can already plug and play and put that on the list. Just give me some weekends and we'll figure it out. But is there anything that you would want to teach in that area just to kind of build some hype around it? Because you've got a lot of skill sets. 48-hour challenge, do you think that's doable out there?
I wouldn't want to do it in the January, February, honestly.
Okay.
With the students. I'd do it myself. But August, it's not as rainy. And they're going to have a little bit of sun to time to dry out. Mm-hmm. So a 48-hour challenge there with the Ziploc or the Moore's pot. So survival kit would be fun. Land nav would be kind of a nightmare with all that vine maple.
Yeah, but you know, like...
But it would be really useful to do a small, like, keeping your orientation tricks.
Right.
Class, because... It is pretty dense over there in Granite Falls and some of those woodland areas.
Yeah, the day one course is a lot of classroom. You know, like we are going over a lot of map reading and route planning and the foundations that people can build on before the day two. I got to work on the day two curriculum here in North Carolina. I'm going to demo it here and then bring it around the country. But day two is more like walk the bearing, guess how far you traveled on your pacing, do some math. It's going to be a lot of field exercises, which can be very time consuming, but you know, when you have a course set up, I mean, I can run that class with my eyes closed. You know, I actually enjoy the 2-day land nav better because I just sit in a chair or sit in the back of my tailgate and I watch people walk. And when they come back, I give everyone feedback. And, you know, I tell them, I'm like, guys, this is a fun class because you get to get out in the field, but I feel like I'm such a deadbeat for just sitting here watching you. So We got some stuff coming to the Pacific Northwest. I'm really excited and I'm very happy that crew had a good time and, you know, I hope to see them again. And, you know, there's just a lot of good stuff out of training in that environment. Like even if you're not from the Pacific Northwest, like we had a guy from New York fly out and he pushed himself. He needs a better knife, but he pushed himself and I give him a lot of credit. I was like, dude, if you can do stuff out here, you can do it in a lot of different places. And, you know, Pacific Northwest, there's no issue with water, but there's an issue with sun. You know what I mean? There's not enough of it. And, you know, in desert conditions in Spanish Fork, there's an issue with plenty of sun, but not a lot of water. So it makes sense to train in different conditions to push your skill sets. And as an instructor, I love it. I love being able to travel and share universals that apply everywhere. But the terrain is really, I mean, you can do the same class in 5 different terrain settings and it's going to be a different class because of what nature provides. What about your final thoughts? Let's leave it to you. What's your greatest takeaway? If you were a student, or I mean, you were the instructor, but you were the instructor, what was your greatest takeaway from the course? Like, what do you want to leave people with?
So something we discussed at the end of the course during our after action review with the students was the skill sets stay generally the same. Your basic items that you need to prioritize for survival stay the same, but your priorities of survival, like as you're saying, the desert versus Pacific Northwest versus the dry side of the mountains here in Washington versus North Carolina, those priorities will change, but your tool set and your knowledge base is going to be your primary thing. Yes, we were really tool heavy, but it's the skill set that really counts. And the students took away a lot of knowledge and it was very, very humbling to watch them struggle at the fire, struggle at the getting comfortable in that continuous out 48 hours basically, and we had 3 hours of sunlight maybe.
Yeah, there was
that time it was raining.
There's that one point
challenging environment to say the least for the students.
At that one point we pointed up and we're like, look, there's a tiny little patch of blue in the sky, and all the students are like, whoa. Because it was just gray. I mean, that type of environment really is a nut punch. There, I mean, it just feels gloomy. And you understand why music, Nirvana and Pearl Jam came out of there. Man, well, dude, I can't thank you enough for for coming out and helping. And I'm excited to see the other courses that we're going to set up out there for you. And, you know, I think the students all appreciated your presence there and all the information that you shared. You know, I think that I might send you a blaze orange keychain. Inside joke. I'll send you a blaze orange keychain. But I had a blast, and I appreciate the heck out of you, buddy.
Orange is my favorite color.
All right, guys, if you want to find out more about two-day survival courses, go to the Fieldcraft Survival website. You can look under training. You can search in your area, or you can search under the type of training. It will say survival. It'll say med. It'll say firearms or whatever. Go there, and you can see where things are. I'll encourage you to reach out to me if you have any questions about the training, the survival side of the house. I'm the training director, so that's going to be all the land nav, the med, survival training. Casey Hildreth is going to be the tactical training director. So that's pistol, carbine, eventually long range. But you guys can reach out to us at any time. We want to train you. We want to make you a better version of yourself. And, you know, our job is to educate, equip, and empower you to do more. So guys, this has been the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Estella. And hopefully you took away a few lessons from this one. And we will talk to you soon.